This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is Wednesday, the 15th of February. And today we are going to be looking at opening a hearing on Senate Bill 5523. And John, why don't you tell us what the plan is?
I was here early.
I know, I'm impressed.
Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, today we are continuing the health-related licensing boards. They're all a part of Senate Bill 5523. Yesterday we heard from three boards, and today we'll hear from the other three boards in this group. The Veterinary Medical Examining Board, Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, and the Board of Medical Imaging. And then, of course, Mr. Medina will be joining us as well from the Chief Financial Office.
Okay. And is Lori here?
She is.
Okay, from the Veterinary Examining Board. And good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner and members. I'm Lori, and out of breath because we just ran in from parking. So I'm Lori Makinen, Executive Director of the Veterinary Examining Board, and this is Dr. Marla McGeorge, who is board member and former chair. Her term ends in June. She's been on the board for almost 9 years. She used to own a cat clinic in Portland, is semi-retired, and now works in Lake Oswego for another practice. So I'd like to start out with a little bit of information about boards, about where we came from, why we're here. In the late part of the 19th century, almost every state in the country had established a regulation over health professions. And this board was established in 1903. It's gone through a number of iterations over the years. It was first vested in the Professional Association, and that didn't work out too well because there were issues of perception of proprietary protectionism, things like that. So by the 60s, the boards were incorporated into the departments of health and commerce, and then by the 80s, became separate independent organizations, but we still had contracted assistance through the Department of Health, and then that didn't work out too well. So a few sessions ago, we lost that contract, gave up that contract, and took services from Shared Client Services, DAS, and that worked out well. And then that didn't work out so well, and so a couple of sessions ago we acquired an accountant that serves all of us, and that's working out very well. There's always been talk about eliminating or consolidating boards, starting in 1909, and then recently, I think in the 2005-2007 biennium, there was talk about consolidation, but it didn't go anywhere because there's never been enough data to support it as being efficient, and the professions don't want consolidation. So that brings us to today, and the authority that we have is vested in Chapter 686. We're an other fund agency. We don't have any policy packages or increases this biennium. We exist only to regulate the veterinary profession, and we do so by enforcing the Veterinary Practice Act. The board comprises 8 members. 5 are veterinarians. 1 is from Astoria, Bend, John Day, Tualatin, and Portland, and we have 1 certified technician who is from, I have to catch my breath, CDT, from Oregon City, and then we have 2 public members from Portland. Our administrative staff is myself, a 0.75 office assistant, a full-time investigator, and then in the last session we got authority for a full-time facility inspector. You can see the current licensee count. If any of you are quick enough to tally the numbers on the right, you'll see that they don't exactly match the numbers on the left because these counts change every day. So the smaller thing I did a few months ago. The other one is effective or current as of last Thursday. So it's, you might note that we have a kind of an unequal distribution of practitioners by county. Most of what we do, oh, do I have to do this?
I can go down if you'd like.
Well, I can figure it out. Okay, most of, and there's a typo. We delegate you authority to staff. The board delegates authority to the staff to deal with all complaints that come in. And the complaints that are deemed to be non-jurisdictional, in other words, the ones that don't relate to a provision in the Practice Act, are what we call staff resolved. These would be things like complaints about fees or bad attitudes or things that we don't regulate. The complaints that are deemed to be jurisdictional go either to the full board or to a rotating committee that previews the complaint to determine at that point whether it needs to go up to the full board. We settle most of these issues through stipulated agreement. We do have a hearing pending right now. And the reason that we try to settle things without going to hearing is that we've spent $10,000 on this one case, and it hasn't even gotten to the hearing point yet. Luckily, though, we did get a summary judgment. We don't have to go to hearing on that, but we still have a $10,000 bill on it. The other case that is, we just lost, I guess lost is probably not the right word, but we did not prevail on appeal on a case that's been around since 2008. And I don't know what costs we might absorb on that. That remains to be seen. So the most common complaints that we get are failure to use proper diagnostic and treatment procedures, failure to use adequate pain management, that's a big one, failure to maintain good records, practicing with an expired license, and substance abuse and diversion. And you can see in the little chart that we pretty much have the same number of complaints consistently. And those numbers look high because I track everything that comes in, not just the complaints that are jurisdictional or that go to the board. So these are, you know, every day somebody's calling, complaining about something, and those get tracked. So we provide technical assistance to licensees. We're still working on our new database project. Hope to have that done soon. The website provides resources for the public and for licensees, shows our current rule, proposed rule changes, shows links to things that are important to veterinarians. The rules that we've adopted during this biennium mostly relate to clarifying provisions for getting a certified veterinary technician license, clarifying who can administer rabies vaccines. That particular rule came out of the case that we just did not prevail on in appeals. It had to do with improper administration of rabies vaccine. We continue to happily to share space with the six other boards, as well as software and hardware, and we do share the accountant position, which again has worked out very well. We've only raised fees twice in 40 years. Our legislation for this session is House Bill 2326, which some of you might remember the last time we had a concept that would allow the board to issue what amounts to a traffic ticket for minor infractions, and there would be no public record of this. Well, it was passed. It wasn't opposed. But when our new AAG looked at the language, she concluded that it did not give us the confidentiality provision, and so this concept fixes that. Our other concept last session was facility inspection, and we're starting to, this year we will start to do the routine inspections. For 2016, it was sort of a get-to-know-me kind of process where we had a lot of, it was mostly educational, and we allowed the practices to self-certify. This familiarized them with the minimum standards that have been in effect for many, 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 many years, and so it was more of a, we wanted to ease into it. This year we'll do the start with the inspections, and we have a couple that are going to be pretty big ones. We had no real clear number to rely on when we proposed this in the last session, we estimated 500 practices. What we have now is over 700 that are registered. However, some of those, we might be looking at rules to exempt certain or waive that registration for practices, such as those that we call them the little black bag practice, where they really don't have a brick and mortar. All they have is we have a bicycle vet in Portland. I'm not sure that he needs to register that bike as a facility, but he did. So we'll be looking at the data going down the road to see if the current, if the fee structure works, if we maybe, you know, taken on too much, or if we need to scale back a bit. So I'm not going to read through these. This is just for your information. These are the minimum standards that facilities have to meet, and they're not onerous. You know, they're pretty basic: heat, air, water. And then telemedicine. The big thing that's coming up is telemedicine. You're probably aware of a couple bills out there that address this. The board is interested in telemedicine. It's been going on to a certain point for a long time. I mean, if you pick up the phone and call your doctor and say, this hurts, they might prescribe over the phone if you have that existing relationship. So that's what the board's going to be looking at. And we do have, in January, the AVMA's final position paper on telemedicine came out, and it's pretty much in line with what I think the board is going to be looking at for making rules to regulate telemedicine. So I'm more than happy to answer any. Hope you'll have some questions for me. Hope you'll approve our budget, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Lori. Are there questions? You use the Attorney General's office for legal assistance?
We do. Yes, Co-Chairman Rowe.
Do you have a contract with a flat fee kind of contract?
Yes, we have a flat fee. It's about $2,900 a month.
$2,900 a month.
Right, and that's based on our usage from last, I think it's a biennial contract.
Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, I believe it's a three-year.
Is it three?
Average contract, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so ours is kind of low, but I think the activity that we've had because of these hearings and various other things, I think that might be ratcheted up just a little bit.
Because of that one contract. Big case that keeps carrying forward?
There's that one big case. We also have a new AAG, so there's been a little bit more time spent getting to know us and also helping to review rules and statutes and make sure that we're heading in the right direction.
I have to ask.
And how many months of ending balance are you carrying?
Co-Chairman Rowe, members, John's going to help me out, but I think it's about 18 months.
Wow.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fernandez.
It's on page 2 of where the budget is, on the last part. It's 17.9 months of operating costs.
That's about 18 months, is what John said.
Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, just to speak on that real quick, it is quite a bit higher than you're typically used to, obviously. Yeah. A couple of things are factoring in there. Number one, this board had their first fee increase last session, so you have more revenue coming in for that. And then they also had the House Bill 2474 last session that passed that did the facility inspections. And again, that's quite a bit more revenue. $150 is the cost for the facility registration. I'm sorry, I think I said inspection. Yeah. For registration. We had estimated 500 facilities at the time of that bill passing, and as Ms. Markkanen said, that they're at 779 so far. So this board has seen quite a bit more revenue than we anticipated, and that's obviously clear in their ending balance to this point.
Yeah. And you know that sometimes we get nervous when ending balances are too much, because there's powers that be that have been known to take out their little broom and do some sweeping. And we don't like to see that happen, so we'd like to keep it in balance, not too low, not too high. Senator Roblin.
So you, with the bill that passed last time, are you now sending someone out to look at each of those facilities? And did you get a chance to do that fully last year, or did you collect the money and then start the process?
Co-chairs, Senator Roblin, last year we did not do inspections as a routine matter. We inspected when there was a complaint, which is what we've always done. This year, in April, we're going to start. We'll deploy the inspector and start to hit all of the practices. Back to John's point, we don't know whether one individual is going to be able to hit the entire state all year. So, we might end up having to hire a contractor, or, I don't necessarily want to ask for another employee without more data, but we could do a contract. We could also, and this is something I'm working on, but not at the moment with Oregon Health Authority because they have enough things to think about, but they have programs that routinely do hospital inspections and facility inspections for radiation equipment. And so if I could kind of get, piggyback with them, have an agreement with them that when their inspectors are out and there's a veterinary practice in the neighborhood, they could do that inspection for us as well.
Yeah. Okay.
And we also have the state public health veterinarian who is out pretty much all over the state at any time, and he could do inspections as well. But again,
follow up, Senator.
Oh yeah, just kind of to add on to that. So these visits, are they surprise visits or are they announced?
Co-chairs, Senator Thompson, they would be announced. What we would plan to do is send them a notice that we will be inspecting at a certain date. We send them everything. They already know, hopefully, what the minimum standards are, but we would send them a reminder of what they are and then come out. And we're looking at this, we're kind of copying the pharmacy board's approach to this, is that it's more education and, rehabilitation if need be, rather than going out and slamming somebody.
Thanks. Okay. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the complaint-driven inspections, do they get warning that you're coming? Do they know the complaint's been filed before you show up, or is it?
Co-chair Senator Roblin, generally they know.
Okay.
We don't have authority, even with the complaint-driven side of things, we don't have authority to just walk in.
Okay.
So we usually do give them a couple days.
Good.
Okay. Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Do you all set key performance indicators for this new inspection process?
Co-chairs, Representative Fernandez, we have not done that.
Are you, follow Mr. Co-chair. Are you required to? Do you do annual strategic planning or biannual?
No.
Additional questions? Okay, thank you very much. And Dr. McGeorge, are you going to speak to us?
I don't think so, unless anyone has any questions for me.
Okay. Well, you're welcome to if you want to. Okay, well, then let's go to, where are we?
DAS.
No, we want to hear from DAS first. Yeah, Anthony. Yeah, Anthony, let's have your presentation.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. Today, I'll be going over the Governor's recommended budget for the Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners. The mission of the Board is to protect animal health and welfare, public health, and consumers of veterinary services. An emerging issue for the agency is their facilities inspections that Lori just got done talking about. The governor's budget maintains existing services and includes a technical adjustment. Here's our expenditure history. And their expenditure is broken down by category. And revenue history as well for the agency. As you can see, for 17-19 compared to 15-17, there is an increase in revenue. This that could be associated with the now licensing of the facilities. The governor's budget supports current services and makes adjustment to the shared account 2 position and adjustments to DAS price list and state government service charges.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
I think we should ask Mr. Mendetta a question. thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Medina, what is a technical adjustment and how much was that technical adjustment?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett. I can pull it up for the agency. It varies per agency because the account 2 position, the apportionment, I went off of 1517 budget bill records that broke it down by percentage for each agency, but however, it's up to the agencies to decide if what agency pays 18% of the position versus 12% of the position.
Just go slow on that one. Explain 18% versus, Mr. Chair, can I?
Go ahead.
I don't understand. What are you saying to me? I have to explain this to my taxpayers in my district. What is?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett. It's broken down on workload, and the agency itself decides its workload for the position.
Okay.
Is that your question, or can I?
And how much is that? What does that total technical adjustment cost, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yeah.
So there are two adjustments. The first is an adjustment switching a figure, and I don't want to say an expenditure. It's an expenditure in essence, but it's shifting an expenditure from an expenditure to a revenue, because currently in the agency's budget for mortuary cemetery, where the position is housed, they don't have revenues coming in from the other agencies to pay for the position. There's no way for veterinary board, for example, in their budget to pay for the services they're receiving, or the services they're giving out for the position from veterinary board, from medical imaging. So what I did in the technical adjustment was I shifted those funds from an expenditure to a revenue transfer within the agency. So that way the agency no longer sees it as an expense, but rather transferring it from one board to another board.
Senator Roblin?
I just want to try to explain it for people. Here's my understanding. You can tell me if I'm wrong. They have one accountant to a person that all six boards pay. So if everybody paid an equal share, they'd pay 18% of that person's job. But they don't each pay an equal share because they don't need as much time. Okay. So they make an adjustment depending on which one uses them more. But the bigger problem was that they don't get six different checks from each different agency. They get a check from one agency, which it turns out to be the cemetery board. And so they have to make a technical adjustment from each of the other five to them to pay the person who's doing the work for all of them.
Thank you, Mr. Cage.
That correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Additional for Mr. Medina? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, we will go to the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, Nancy Schulberg. Come on up.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Schulberg. I'm the director of the board and have been the executive director for 8 months. Today with me is Michelle Painter, our board chair, and she is our OT assistant member. She is in her eighth and final year on the board. We have 4-year terms. Our programs are licensing and investigations to make sure we protect the public and provide safe and ethical delivery of OT services in the state. Our board was established in 1977 with just a few hundred licensees, and we are now at 2,400. And I'd say by the end of the biennium, we'd be on pace to reach 2,500. Occupational therapy is among the fastest growing professions in the state, and nationwide, and our total licensees have almost doubled within the last 12 years. Our board meets quarterly and is composed of 5 members. We have 2 OTs, our 1 OT assistant, and 2 public members. And our staff includes a full-time executive director and a half-time administrative assistant. The board also has a professional services contract with a former board member to help with investigations, and she does an excellent job. Our discipline has grown to about an average of 14 to 15 cases per year. The board expects the number of complaints to continue to increase as we get more licensees every year. And I'll get into more detail about those complaints in just a minute. Our renewals are done online every 2 years, even years. And renewals fall 8 months after the start of the biennium. So we need to have at least 8 months of cash reserves to start the biennium. We have held our current fees. They're a two-year rate of $150 for OTs and $100 for OTAs. We've kept those fees current for over 10 years now.
Have you considered going to birth date renewal to spread it out over the whole calendar?
Not since I've been in this role. It hasn't been a problem for us. We haven't, you know, there's been nothing, it hasn't really been a problem for us to have the cash reserves. We usually have plenty.
Okay. Senator Roblin?
So do you have an online system for payment yet? I mean, have you put it digitized?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Renewals mostly are by credit card.
Okay.
And we just get a few checks now.
Okay.
We perform background LEDS checks on all licensees prior to renewals. We've done that the past 2 renewal periods, and we will continue to do so.
And those are done by the state police, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
And Senator Roblin?
And do you charge the fee for that, or do you take care of the fee?
That is absorbed. We do not charge the licensees for that.
Okay, so you just have it done and take it out of the $150 or the $100
correct
that they're paying. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's
good management.
And those, yeah. And those background checks, we believe, cost about $80 or about $40 each.
As a board, we focus on educating the licensee on what's going on with the board, the laws and rules, whenever possible. We have a quarterly e-newsletter, and we give notice on rulemaking and reminders to all licensees. Our website, we just have completed our update to the new V4, more user-friendly format. It's not live yet, but it's being reviewed right now by the eGov folks,
okay,
and we expect that to go live soon. I present to the graduating OTD students at Pacific University and the OTA students at Lynn Benton every year about the board, our rules and statutes, how to get licensed, and their obligations under licensure. We have a new law ethics exam. Well, it's been in place since 2014, and that's required of all new applicants. And we also present every year at our association meeting, and we work closely with our schools and the association. And since you've seen us last, we've done well meeting our performance goals. We license applicants 98% of the time within 2 to 3 days of receiving all the required documentation. With applicants, we do check education, primary source verification from any state they've ever worked, as well as our National Certification Board. As I mentioned, we have implemented our online law ethics exam required of all new applicants. It's very easy for them to do, and it's at no cost to them. And we also track pain management. As mentioned, we, by other directors, we do coexist with the 833 boards, and we help each other out, not only dividing the costs of IT and accounting and the copier and the fax and the office space, but also with administrative functions. If I have a question or there's something I haven't dealt with before, I seek out the other directors and the staff, and they are very supportive and willing to give me some guidance and support. We have timely resolution of complaints, typically within 120 days. We investigate complaints as immediately as they come in and present the case at the next board meeting, and the board makes a determination. Because we have relatively small discipline, we look at all open cases at every board meeting, and sometimes a case will stay open for a longer period of time if there's something that we are following up on. If part of the agreement states that the licensee submits quarterly performance evaluations for their supervisor at work, or if we're following up on a mandatory CE audit, so they can stay on our radar for over 2 years until they have met all the requirements of the consent order. We have high customer service satisfaction, and we continue to maintain over 98% ratings of good or excellent. The survey results and comments are shared with the board on an annual basis, and we're always looking for ways we can improve. The board does follow best practices and takes them very seriously, and we look at these every year, such as monitoring monthly expenditures and the key performance measures. The board has been successful keeping our costs down by settling cases by consent order, and we have not had a case go to hearing through the costly administrative hearing process. I understand from the DOJ director that met with us last year that a simple case that goes through the appeals process can cost $50,000. Last biennium, 2013-15, we had a case go on and on, and the case was settled a week prior to the scheduled hearing, and our legal costs came within $600 of our limitation for that biennium. And had the case gone on to the judicial review, we've been over our limitation. So to address this, we have a policy package this session to address AAG costs. And our Attorney General limitation for the 2017-19 budget at the CSL is around $24,000, and the governor budget has approved a $12,000 increase to $37,000 in the event we had a case go to hearing. In addition, the board just entered into the flat charge agreement in August of 2016 with the DOJ that allows us to spread out the legal costs over the three biennia. And we feel taking these two steps will allow us to be better prepared in the event of a judicial review and in the future, and avoid a trip to the e-board. And finally, we are not asking for a fee increase this biennium, but we think if the number of complaints grew down the road, there might be a possible need for a permanent quarter-time investigator. But for now, we are managing well with our current FTE that we have. That's all I have, and I thank you for your time and your consideration of our budget.
And your reserves are how many months, do you know?
It's 8 months.
8 months, okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Good morning. I appreciate this. I did not ask the Veterinary Board because I knew the answer already, but one of the things we're working on the Veterans Affairs Committee is license reciprocity for people who are coming out of the service with these skills. I can't recall from 2011 if your board was one of the ones that we did or not. I probably need to go pull up that legislation, but curious if you have that reciprocity for licensure so that people who are returning out of the service and their spouses back to Oregon don't have to jump through additional hoops if they've been practicing elsewhere in the country.
I checked our policy. We have written in our policy to expedite any applications that for licensure that for OTs who work in the military, including their spouses and partners. It's also written that the board would consider on a case-by-case basis whether to grant a request from active duty military person to exempt them from a licensee fee or give them extension to the CE requirement. But we do not have, like, reciprocity. They would need a license unless they are working at the VA.
Go ahead.
Have you gotten any people who've requested that?
We've had...
And have you turned anybody down?
I've been with the board for about 3.5 years. I was the licensing person before I took this role. And we've had about one person from the military. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Roblin?
Thank you. And thank you for all the age and distribution statistics, because it's really nice to see that. You're better off than many places with respect to the coming in, but you're still a little heavy on the people who've been around for a long time. As they retire, are the two schools, the one for the assistants and the ones for the therapists, that's all we have in Oregon. Are they producing at a rate that you feel meets the need over time, or are we having to import more and more people?
Would you like to comment on
that? Yes, co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner and Senator
Give your
Roland.
Name first.
Michelle Painter. Sorry.
No
I'm
problem.
Nervous.
It's okay.
I am currently faculty at Lynn Benton Community College in the Occupational Therapy Assistant Program. Okay. We accept a cohort of 24 students each year.
Okay.
We are a hybrid program, very unique in the United States in that we have, of that cohort of 24, one-third of them are considered traditional students that come to campus, and the other two-thirds are students that attend online throughout the state, particularly in rural areas such as Pendleton, Medford, coastal areas. So we have good representation across the state, and those students who attend online do come to campus a couple times per term for exams, but otherwise they do their laboratory experiences and their field work. Clinical experiences where they live, so that, and many of them do get offered positions where in their home area where they live because they have done their clinical affiliations there. So we feel while there's always room for growth, I'm continuing to cultivate partnerships with other community colleges in Oregon so that we can accept more students, but at this time, with lack of fieldwork experiences, it's very hard to grow the program too quickly to meet the demand, but we're reporting a high number of our students getting full-time employment after graduation.
Additional? Representative
Wisnett? Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It's along Senator Roblin's questions. I was looking at the charts. If everyone watching it, there's a lot of good charts about the workforce of this occupation. It appeared to be a little low in Central Oregon because we have a lot of seniors out there needing that. But what's amazing is for me was that employment's 91%, and that it looks like the number licensed is young enough that you do have the adequate workforce. I guess the question is, how about, I know like for nurses, our problem is not people wanting to be nurses, but teachers that are master's degree to teach. How about your profession? Is that also a problem to find your teaching? So is that a problem to find teachers that with master's degree in this career field?
Co-chairs and Representative Wilson, sorry. So it's more of a challenge for the doctoral programs, the professional program at Pacific University, because of the accreditation requirements of their teaching faculty having doctorate degrees. So there is more of an impact with those professional programs than at the technical level where I teach, because most occupational therapists, they're entry level at master's. So finding qualified educators to teach in technical programs, associate degree programs, is not as much of a challenge as it is for the post-professional programs.
The follow-up, Mr. Chair, because a lot of us were talking to nurses yesterday and last night, and I know that a nurse with a master's degree can make more in a hospital than they can teaching. Is that a factor too in anything in trying to?
There certainly is a range of income, or you know, what someone could expect to earn depending on what setting they work in, whether it's education or whether it's in K-12 school settings or rural practice. So there is some of that inconsistency, and honestly, I don't know what the faculty make at Pacific University. It's a private institution, so I don't really know how that compares with other practicing OTs in the field.
Thank you. Thank you, Coach.
Representative Parrish.
Question on some of the kind of the spike in licensure. You know, that really seems to coincide with when we expanded Medicaid is when you start to see a licensure go up. So how much of that do you attribute to of the sort of growth in your industry to the Medicaid expansion? And if that is related, then, you know, if we have cuts in that program, what do you expect in terms of, you know, do you see a dip in people practicing here? Does it create sort of a, is there like a little bit of a bubble going on with some of these licenses, health licenses?
Representative Parrish, I can speak to the occupational therapy assistant spike specifically. You'll see that there is a dip in the early 2000s. The program at Mount Hood Community College closed in 2002. So for about 8 years, there was not an occupational therapy assistant program in Oregon until Lynn Benton opened their program and accepted their first cohort in 2010. So that's why you do see an increase, is because there was not a technical program for about 8 years.
Thank you very much. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
You did a great job. Sorry for being nervous.
Thank you.
Anthony, you're on.
We're going to have a huge, I think there's this problem.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. And today I'll be going over the governor's recommended budget for the Board of Occupational Therapy. The mission of the board is to protect the public by supervising occupational therapy practice and to assure safe and ethical delivery of occupational therapy services. An emergent issue for the agency is a licensee growth and correlated disciplinary costs. The governor's budget maintains existing services, includes a technical adjustment, and adds limited resources. Here's a breakdown of the agency's expenditure history. And expenditure broken down by category. Here's a revenue history. It's relatively been consistent. The governor's budget supports current services and makes the following adjustment. It increases limitation for legal fees. It transfers the OHA workforce database, funds that the agency's collected for that, and an adjustment to the shared account to apportionment, as well as adjustments for the DAS price list and state government service charges. I could answer any questions the committee might have.
Questions for Mr. Medina? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess we can go to medical imaging now. Mr. Conlow. Welcome.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Ed Conlow. I'm the executive director of the Board of Medical Imaging. The board is a licensing agency overseen by a 12-person board, including four physicians, five licensees, one from each of the different licensure categories that we oversee, and also three public members. The board licenses technologists and limited X-ray permit holders. We oversee education programs for limited X-ray We approve CE classes in cooperation with the National Registry that deals with medical imaging. We currently issue 5,573 licenses. It's about a one-third increase over 4 years when we added, back in 2010, over six years, we added MRI, nuclear medicine, and sonography as licensure categories. The Board of Medical Imaging has the most comprehensive oversight of medical imaging in the nation.
Senator Roblin.
So can multiple licenses be held by one person?
Yes.
So when you're talking about the 5,000, that's not 5,000 people necessarily.
I'm trying not to double count those folks.
And oh, okay.
So if I pull up the numbers, there's 6,000 some, and I can sort of combine them, and it comes out as 5,500. Okay. So I think
Thank
I'm
you.
Not double counting. If someone orders the most typical one is radiography and MRI. A lot of folks seem to cross-train and get a radiography license and X-ray and then cross-train into MRI. If they do that, we'll add it to their license, and we don't double charge them.
Oh, okay.
It's all, we'll pile on whatever they can earn, we'll pile onto one license.
That's nice to hear.
We are a three-person office. Funded through a license fee that's $120 for 2 years, and I don't see us raising that anytime soon. We work collaboratively with other agencies to share resources, as has already been discussed. We share accounting services. We share office space with the other health boards in the Portland State Office Building. Under the Oregon Health Authority, there's an office called Radiation Protection Services. They regulate the machines and anything to do with X-ray. Radiation Protection Services, they go out and they inspect this stuff. We work closely with them on statutes and rules, and they serve as advisory members on our board. We work also closely with other health boards. In sort of sorting through different regulatory issues that kind of overlap. One example is a year or two ago, we adopted legislation to allow physician assistants to operate fluoroscopy, which is like a X-ray movie. And it's a heavy dose of radiation. But so we worked with the medical board and also the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants to get that done. We've had recent conversations with the Board of Nursing on some issues that they have regarding fluoroscopy, and those conversations are ongoing at this time. So we have a projected ending balance for the upcoming biennium of $166,000, which is about 4.3 months of spending. Our renewals are monthly. We renew on birth month, so we don't have any spikes. It's pretty constant, and we have a flat rate contract with the AG's office, so I don't expect any surprises in that regard, any big bills, because they average it over three biennia. And our agency is self-funded through license fees. We have challenges. Numbers of licensees creeps upward. It may be 100 to 200 per year in that range. Our goal, and I think we can manage this, is to keep going with existing resources and the existing fee structure. We've always done background checks, state background checks, through the state police on new and renewal licenses, the LEDS background checks that the state police does. A couple years ago, we added fingerprints to that, that's working very well. We've had it can, and we do only do the fingerprints on initial licenses. Renewals, we just do the LEDS background check. Every renewal, we do a background check with the state police. Initial license only, we require the fingerprint background check. That's created a little bit more work for us, because we've had more instances where individuals who are applying for an initial license don't report criminal background, and that's a disciplinary case that'll go before the board. So that's increased our workload somewhat. It slows down doing the fingerprint check slows down the initial licensure process. We're very quick with licenses. We can usually get them done within a couple days. We tell people within five business days. At various times, that's been a little bit of a stretch because it depends on we get the background check back electronically from the state police, the fingerprint background check. And at various times, that's been a little taken a little longer, but they're very quick these days, so we're optimistic about that. We deal in a health environment that is in a constant state of evolution, mainly through the evolution of technology. Mm-hmm. So things are changing, and we kind of find out about it after a product is already out there. And sometimes we scramble to figure out if we're supposed to regulate. And an example would be in legislation that passed the House last Friday, HB 2267, there was a provision in there to exempt ophthalmic sonography from our licensure law. We had just found out. We didn't realize there was this animal out there called very specialized sonographers who deal just in ophthalmology. And we learned that there's two of these folks at KCI Institute at OHSU. And they go through a different pathway to get their registry, their national registry, and they're highly trained and highly specialized. I asked the board, what do you want to do? And they suggested at this point, due to the low number and because of the specialization, that we exempt them from licensure at this time. So that's one of the provisions that legislation did that passed the House and is now over in the Senate. We're dealing with this stuff constantly, especially in sonography. It's just there's products that come along that are new and different applications. Going forward, my hope is we focus on customer service, keep licenses issued within a couple days. I think that helps people a lot. Respond promptly to inquiries that come up. We try to improve communication with licensees working on the newsletter, which goes out a couple times a year, to an email list, and trying to improve the website as much as we can to provide information. The only policy package we have in the budget is policy package 126, which was also included in HB 2267. To recognize a new pathway to obtain a bone densitometry permit. There's a pathway currently that we use, but it's kind of only one guy teaches the class, and he may stop teaching it. So there's this other registry that's out there that's recognized within the imaging community. So I asked the board, do you want to recognize that registry? And then people that have that credential can get this bone densitometry permit. And that's one provision this legislation would permit. Thanks for your consideration.
Senator Roblin.
So you have a fairly low fee. $60 a year, approximately.
Yes.
So when it comes to things like we add or background checks and those kind of stuff, and that initial one where it's the fingerprint.
Yes.
Do they get charged for that? Do they pay that themselves?
They pay that themselves.
I would, because it would take most of your annual fee if you didn't. So I was hoping you did.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Thank you.
Representative Lively.
So I believe you said that the license that's 2-year cycles.
Yes.
And so you mentioned something about technology changing and that. So what happens, so if there's new instruments or that they decide to use, what happens from the standpoint of their license or whether they're licensed to do that or not, given the fact that it may happen within that 2-year cycle?
I mean, usually when we come upon something that maybe wasn't on our radar screen, a new technology, I mean, we see where it fits within existing licenses. Mm-hmm. The licensure categories are fairly broad in most cases. Most of the new technology is coming up through sonography, it seems to me. That's where I seem to get surprised the most. our sonography license is pretty broad. If you have a sonography license, you can do any form of sonography.
So if I might, Mr. Co-Chair, so is there some verification of that they've been trained? So I'm just trying to get the connection. I appreciate the license covers it, but is there some verification that somebody's trained them or they took?
So there's several national registries that we recognize. To get a full license, you have to have a credential from one of these registries, and it requires several years of education, some clinical requirements, and they have to pass an exam. So there's a sonography registry. There's one called the American Registry of Radiology Technologists that has like the most credentials available. We recognize four or five separate registries. In terms of continuing education, they have to keep their registry renewed on an annual basis, and so for that they have to do continuing education. So for the full licenses, we don't have to check their CE, which is real nice. Mm-hmm. For the limited permits, that's a state-only program, and for that they have to submit CE with their renewal application.
Great.
And
Thank
we
you.
Check it every time.
Senator Roblin?
And I'm going to follow up a little bit on Rep. Lively's. So I have a certificate for X-ray or whatever, and in that my two-year licensure, I also pick up another one for one of the other deals. Do you just add it on to their license without charging them if they give you the information, or do they pay an initial fee because they're getting a new license?
We just add it.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Nice.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. You and I had the pleasure of meeting briefly yesterday and talking, and I appreciate all the good information in here. And I'm just particularly what you said about technology really driving your licensure. That's so much. It's interesting that it hasn't come up in more of these boards, honestly, that it really is such a big impact in your board in particular. We had talked a little bit yesterday, and I just wanted to ask you about some of the issues that have come up, particularly in fluoroscopy, apparently, about folks who are supervising. You talked about the physician's assistant coming up with a situation and that you're currently in conversation with the nursing board. Could you just expand a little more upon where you got to with PAs and kind of what you're talking about with the nursing folks now?
So with the PAs, they approached us a couple years ago, and they said they would like to be able to help out when they're doing this fluoroscopy procedure. Apparently you need three arms to do it, and they said, well, we're standing right there, let us mm-hmm. step on this pedal. And it turns out that there is a course available through the American Association of Physician Assistants jointly with the American Society of Radiologic Technologists. So it had sort of this blessing from the RadTech world that PAs could, you know, were approved if they took this course and passed this exam, and they could help out in the fluoro room operating the fluoroscopy. So
that would, if I could just for a moment. So if they did that, they would do that, and they wouldn't get licensed by you guys. They would just have their own certificate that they could.
They would
help?
It actually would. They would get a permit from us.
Ah, okay.
So it's not like a national license, but it's more of a confined sort of thing. But
okay.
Yes, they would get a piece of paper from us.
Okay.
And they'd have to do CE every 2 years and submit it for renewal.
Okay.
So we worked with the PAs to get that done. And it was easier because there was this coursework that was already developed. We didn't have to invent that new. I think that helped, and it had sort of the blessing of this national RadTech association that they sort of recognize this course. So that I think that helped pave the way. So then we've had discussions more recently with the nurses about supervising fluoroscopy. So advanced practice nurses to supervise fluoroscopy. Ruby Jason from the Nursing Board approached me last summer, and I took her over to visit with David Howe from the Oregon Health Authority's Radiation Protection Services, because they deal with a lot of those rules. Radiation Protection Services set up a rules advisory committee, and they developed a specific training program for someone who would be in this situation to supervise fluoroscopy. What we discovered late in the game was that there was, in our definition, in our statute, it says there's a definition that says medical imaging licensee is someone who is supervised by a physician. So I thought this was a potential roadblock that if the advanced practice nurse was going to be directing the RadTech. The RadTech would operate, the advanced practice nurse would direct, and would be, I guess, looking at the image. If that would be considered supervising, then that would be a statutory barrier. So I said, let's take this to our board at our January meeting and see if that could be resolved, because we had a piece of legislation and we could attack an amendment on there if need be, if folks agreed. Anyway, so it didn't it wasn't resolved at the January board meeting. There was discussion back and forth with some of our board members, mainly the radiologists and Ruby from the nursing board and also the nurses association. So it didn't get resolved at that meeting, and I emailed back and forth with Ruby after that, and we were going to try to see if we could get maybe a smaller group together and try to figure out. We never really got to sort of discuss the details and figure out if there was some common ground, and that's what I was hoping we would get out of that meeting, and I'm still hoping we can do that.
Okay. Additional? Representative Hernandez?
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. You said you set up an advisory group to propose or come up with some training or requirements. Who was part of that advisory group, and were the advanced practice nurses at that table?
Representative Hernandez, members of the committee. Actually, the advisory group was set up by Radiation Protection Services. I believe that it did include, it included the Nurses Association, the Nursing Board. I think there was someone there who was from the nurse anesthetist, I believe. I don't have the exact list, and I did not set it up. But it also included the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists. They had representatives there. I mean, I think it had broad representation, and I think they were agreeing on some training requirements. But I don't have the exact list, and it's available. I can get it for you if you'd like.
Okay. Anything additional? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Boy, what a critical area. In the medical field, there's so rapid changes, and if you have a doctor like I had that doesn't keep up with everything, they might give you the wrong treatment for what's ailing you. And that happened to me once, and the old geezer finally retired, and I got a new young doctor, and he said, "Rod, we're not treating you properly," and the got me all taken care of, so it's kind of a critical area. Mr. Medina.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. Today I'll be going over the Governor's recommended budget for the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. The The governor's budget maintains existing services, includes a technical adjustment, and expands the licensee base. Here's a representation of their expenditures. And the expenditures broken down by category between personnel services and services and supplies.
Now this one, the ratio there between personal services and services and supplies is a little different than some of the ones we've just seen. It has a little more on services and supplies. Is that AG costs, or, you know, why is it tilted that way?
I could look for you, Coach Monroe.
Well, it's just we've been the others that we were looking at were all, virtually all 75-25, and this one's 40-60. Mm-hmm. So I wondered what was the reason for that.
Coach Monroe, I wouldn't know until I looked directly at my chart, but just my initial assumption is that a lot of these licensing boards, their expenditures relative to the size of the agency are fairly small. For this agency, it's roughly $900,000 broken down between a biennia. So even a minor fluctuation in AG cost over time could make a larger increase in the percentage, if that makes sense.
Okay. Go ahead.
So history of their agency's revenues. For 17-19, we do assume the agency will receive revenues from the new bone densitometry permit. However, Director Conlow assumed only 10 people applied to the permit at $120. There's an additional $1,200 in revenue there, but you can't tell. The governor's budget maintains current services and supports the bone densitometry certification, transfers out fees collected by the agency for the OHA workforce database survey, and adjustments to the shared account to apportionment, as well as adjustments to the DAS price list and state government service charges.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Medina? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care of that cough.
I know, I need to.
Okay, we are going to set over. Well, first of all, close the hearing on 5523. Was there anybody else that wanted to be heard? No. And Mr. Wilson, do you want us to go with you for a few minutes? We can do that. So we'll reopen the informational hearing on education overview.
Mr. Chair, it's up to you and the committee. There's sort of 5-6 minutes left by the looks of it till the end of the time. Tomorrow you have one board and a short presentation by the Oregon Youth Governor. Hopefully there'd be more time. If not, I'm going to just go ahead on Monday at the beginning of the hearing to finish this up before the executive branch starts with their overview. Well, I hate to do things in little pieces.
I know. Let's plan on doing it tomorrow. We'll probably have at least a half an hour tomorrow.
And that should be sufficient.
That should be enough to finish it. Okay. Anything else for the good of the order?
I hope you carried it over, Mr. Chair.
We did. I carried. Okay, I think I just did that. I carried over the educational overview to tomorrow, February the 16th. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Anything? We are adjourned.